Hey there, welcome back to another episode of Lost Origins, your number one radio show for all things ancient mystery, alternative historical theory, and lost civilizations. I'm your host, Andrew, and I challenge every single one of you to hop on your computer or your mobile device, head over to lost-origins.com, check out our site, read an article, engage with the community, and sign up for that free newsletter. You guys, I just wanted to take a second to thank every single one of you who have ever engaged with us online, on social media, shared an article, read an article, commented on an article. Watching Lost Origins grow has been an amazing experience, and it wouldn't be where it's at without you, our listeners, our readers, and our patrons. So thank you so much. You guys can also connect with us on social media. We are on almost every single platform: Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. So hit that subscribe button. Never miss an episode or an article from your friends here at Lost Origins. This week's episode of Lost Origins is brought to you by Voyages to Legendary Times and our good friend Georgia Tsoukalos. Voyages to Legendary Times is a company that exists to help make the ancient astronaut theory more accessible for those who want to witness the evidence themselves, while simultaneously being accompanied by a knowledgeable guide. So this summer, Giorgio is going to be leading a two-week expedition to Peru and Bolivia, where you're going to be able to check out and explore Pumapunku, Tiahuanaco, Sacsayhuaman, Machu Picchu, the Nazca Lines, so much more. This is an explorer's dream trip, and if you're a fan of the ancient astronaut theory, you're going to be able to go to these sites with Giorgio, pick his brain, get to know him, and get his take on these sites and how they impact the ancient astronaut theory. So the capacity for this trip is very limited, 40 slots. So the last time I talked to Giorgio, it was sounding like this thing was getting close to being sold out. Head over to their website, voyagestolegendarytimes.com. Learn more about the tour and pick up your tickets while you still can. This week's episode is also brought to you by our good friends over at Inner Traditions and Baron Company. Inner Traditions has been publishing books on esoteric philosophy, New Age spirituality, and alternative health for well over 40 years. You guys can check out their website at innertraditions.com. You can learn more about their books, their authors, sign up for coupons, special offers, so on and so forth. We have absolutely loved working with those guys. Every book we've ever read that they publish has just been dynamite, and their authors are some of the top researchers in the field, and we highly recommend Inner Traditions and Baron Company for all your reading needs. You guys, I am so excited for the conversation that we're about to have today. This week, we are joined by none other than forensic geologist, researcher, and author Scott Walter. Scott is the host of History's H2 Channel's hit show, America Unearthed, which follows him on his quest to uncover the truth behind historic artifacts and sites found throughout North America. He's also the author of several books, including The Kensington Runestone and The Hooked X. Scott has been president of the American Petroglyph Services since 1990, and he has been involved with more than 7,000 investigations throughout the world. So today we're going to be discussing his work surrounding the Kensington Runestone, the Hooked X, the Templars, and what this means for the secret history of America right after the break. All right, ladies and gentlemen, and we are back. If you're just tuning in, I'm your host, Andrew, and this week's guest needs absolutely no introduction. But we all know good and well that I'm going to try to do it justice. This week's guest has frequented the History Channel, has written droves of books, has explored the secret history of America, the Hooked X, the Kensington Runestone, America Unearthed. This is a brief example of the laundry list of books and accomplishments that this internationally known forensic geologist has been a part of. Scott Walter is joining us today, and Scott has been president of the American Petroglyph Services since 1990, and he has participated in more than 7,000 investigations throughout the world. So I am so excited to dig into the secret history of America, and it is my pleasure to welcome Scott Walter to this week's episode of Lost Origins. Scott, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it's my pleasure, Andrew. And who was that guy you were talking about? That was a very impressive resume. No, I'm just kidding.
No, there's no pressure, right? Nothing to live up to there.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I really appreciate it. And I really enjoy doing these interviews and getting a chance to talk about things that I find interesting, and hopefully your audience will as well.
That's the reason we do it. We love exploring ancient mysteries. We love exploring these alternative theories. And we really love the fact that Lost Origins is a platform for researchers, authors, and scientists like yourself to be able to talk about these theories in a way that's not, you know, condemning as it would be through academia, you know. So it's definitely been a blast putting this thing together. So what I always like to do when I have a guest on the show that has not been with us before, I always like to give them the opportunity to talk a little bit about their background, who they are, what got them into this field. That way, any listeners that we have that aren't super familiar with your work, they kind of gain an understanding of who you are. So sure. I would like to know more specifically the specifics of forensic geology, right? When I think of forensic geology, I'm thinking of the combination of like CSI and rocks, right? So, I don't know if that's way off point, but kind of give us a breakdown of your work and the definition of forensic geology.
Well, actually, what you just described is pretty darn close. And when I talk to people about what I do for a living or what I've done for the past 31 years now, is basically I perform autopsies on concrete and rock. I literally dissect samples of concrete, for the most part, and rock that gets submitted to our laboratory that's struggling for one reason or another. Typically, something has gone wrong on a project, or it's an old structure and they're evaluating it for renovation or whatever the case might be. So they'll send samples to us. We literally perform an autopsy. We dissect them. We generate different types of samples. We'll test them and get a general assessment as to what the condition of the concrete is, but more specifically, what they want to know is what caused the problem, and the real kicker is who's responsible.
Sure.
So you can imagine that we get involved in a lot of legal cases. I testify as an expert witness very frequently. So it's really a very detailed, very involved process, and it's about the purest form of scientific method that there is. And once we generate our data, which will lead to our interpretations and ultimately conclusions, if we have enough evidence, which we usually do in the case of concrete, because what I like to tell people is that the concrete didn't crack or have low strength or whatever just to make you mad. It is making you mad, but it did it for a reason. And if we get good representative samples and we do our investigation properly, we'll figure it out. There's always an answer, and just about every time we'll find that answer.
Right. That's fascinating. And so it's not just this type of research and these types of reports that you're putting together. I mean, you are a very prominent figure in the ancient mysteries world as well. So before we start digging into the lost or secret history of America,
right.
I do want to talk about what kind of drew you into this world, because I've been a long time fan of America Unearthed. And I know before the show, you and I were talking about how my wife and I, we find ourselves rewatching episodes of that show frequently. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Thank you for putting it together. It's been a huge resource for us, and it's only continued to grow our interest in ancient mystery. What got you into that world? I mean, what really drew you in, piqued the interest to the point where you would become a recognized authority in that field?
Well, it was completely by accident, really, and it started in 2000 when the Kensington Rune Stone one of the biggest mysteries and probably the most well-known mysterious artifact in North America, came into our laboratory. It was submitted by the Runestone Museum up in Alexandria, Minnesota, where it's currently housed. Mm-hmm. And they asked us to do a forensic analysis on it. And specifically what they wanted us to do was to try to determine the age of the carvings, looking at the geological weathering. And I remember when it came in, I had never heard of it. And I found it to be an interesting project, but you know, we get a lot of interesting projects. We've worked on murder cases. We worked on the Pentagon after 9/11, looking at all the fire damage concrete. And yes, it was a plane that hit the Pentagon. A lot of people have questioned that, but I can guarantee you it was. And that's probably the project that I'll be remembered for more than anything that I do in my life with regard to forensic geology. But the runestone was really the thing that got me involved in looking at alternative history. And we ended up doing our forensic analysis and comparing the weathering of tombstones of known age with the same minerals, same grain size, same weathering environment. And I came to the conclusion that the weathering was older than 200 years from the date it was pulled out of the ground in 1898, which effectively made a late 19th century hoax that many people still believe to be impossible.
Right.
So if it's not a late 19th century hoax, then it must be genuine. It's really the only other thing that you have. And once I said that, which I thought would make these people happy, or you know, was the answer, fortunately for them, that they were looking for, many people started to criticize and attack me, and I didn't understand why this was happening. I understand now, but it was very confusing, and that really prompted me to want to dig deeper, and I did.
Right.
So it was on. It was on after that.
Well, and good for you. I mean, I don't think anybody is ever prepared for that. I mean, if you look at the criticism that Dr. Robert Schock from Boston University, for example, that
right.
he went through after him and John Anthony West performed their analysis at the Giza Plateau. I mean, when you upset the apple cart or rub the cat the wrong way, or you know whatever other metaphor you want to assign to this, you know, the black ball of academia hits hard.
Well, you know, I don't mind, excuse me, I don't mind if people want to criticize me, but don't tell me what you think or what you believe. Show me your evidence to support what you believe.
Right.
And that's what I don't see. Now, there are people that will come on, you know, certain outlets and talk about why they don't think it's a hoax. But again, you know, this isn't a matter of faith, it's a matter of evidence, and the evidence that they try to put forth is either completely bogus or it's not germane, it's not relevant. But at the end of the day, I think one of the things that people don't fully appreciate and understand is that in forensics, the dirty little secret is that if you have voluminous evidence, as we do in the case of the runestone, from multiple disciplines that all converge at one place, in this case, authenticity, then how can there possibly be factual evidence to support the contrary?
Right.
By definition, it can't exist. And it doesn't exist. And so, you know, I think some people either don't believe me or don't want to believe that if somebody can come forward with factual evidence that is in conflict or supports an alternate conclusion to the conclusions that I've reached, I'll listen to them and I will accept them. I have yet to see one piece of factual evidence, and I doubt that I ever will, because it simply doesn't exist.
Right.
And so that's all I ask people to do. Listen, I will absolutely accept anyone that comes forth with something that's viable or legitimate, and that just hasn't happened yet.
Right. Well, and I think that that's one of the biggest disconnects that we have right now, not only within the historical community, the archaeological community, or even just the general public, is a lack of open minds, right? And that's, I think, just so unfortunate, because there are so many things that we do not know definitively about our story, about our history. And the only way that I believe we're ever going to truly uncover those is if there is a collaborative effort to analyze different points of our past from a new perspective. And I think your work is doing that, Scott. So,
well, you know, I think one of the issues is that, you know, when we came out, or when we continue to come out with all these, what some people would say, different ideas or different thoughts, which to me doesn't make a lot of sense. To me, it's very logical, and this is what the evidence supports, and this is the history that it tells. To me, it's not alternate. It's just what it is.
Yeah.
But regardless of that, you've got people that are hesitant to accept it and consider it seriously for all kinds of reasons, most of them being what I call problems of the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
And that's unfortunate, but it's the world that we live in. But
right.
Having said that, I do find it unfortunate that there are people out there, especially academics, that just refuse to even consider things that they've already made their minds up about.
Right.
And, you know, instead of being open-minded, instead of being scientific, being open to considering new evidence, they just shut the door because they just don't want to go there because their minds are made up.
Right.
And these are the people that are criticizing me for not being scientific and not understanding the scientific method and not having proper qualifications. And it's laughable, really, when you look at what they're doing. And all it is they're just protecting their beliefs. They're protecting a paradigm, and it doesn't help anybody. We don't make progress. We don't move forward. And I think the other thing that's really sad is that by protecting their paradigm and preserving their belief systems, it hurts everyone.
Right.
And it's just the antithesis of what academics and academia is supposed to be about. It's really, really tragic. However, I want to point out one thing that I hope will happen. I think it's going to happen. But one of the most vocal skeptics out there, who's a professor at a large university in Ohio, has wrote a blog, and he basically made an invitation to all of the what he calls fringe researchers out there that are supporting this alternate view of history, which of course includes myself. And he made a public challenge for them to come to one of his classes and give a lecture about their fringe ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And I accepted his challenge.
Oh, wow.
And I think I shocked him. And, you know, I don't know if this is going to happen or not. I want to believe that he's sincere and genuine about his invitation. I have talked to him a couple of times, and I believe that he is sincere. But he is one of the real negative Nellies, if you will. And some people have warned me that this is just a setup, and I don't want to believe that.
Right.
I want to believe that this is a sincere invitation, that this is a genuine opportunity by somebody who is considered one of the closed-minded ones to actually be open-minded, to give us access to his students, let us present the evidence, and let's see what they say. And if it does go over well, which I really hope it does, this could be one of those first opportunities to reach across the aisle for both of us to put aside the name calling and the negative stuff that's been going on.
Mm-hmm.
And let's have an open dialogue, because what I see is if these guys really do open their minds up and realize that maybe what they've been teaching and what they believe is not correct, and that there is something new and exciting and tells a different story, you know, it doesn't mean that they were wrong or that they were stupid. When you look, consider new evidence, and you accept good, hard scientific facts that tell a different story, it doesn't mean that you were wrong. It means that you're smart, and it means that this truly is the scientific method.
Right.
That's how it works. When new evidence comes in, that dictates a new conclusion, you go there.
Right.
That's what a smart, legitimate professional scientist does, and that's what academia should also do. And I'm hoping this will be an opportunity to maybe open a new door of collaboration. And boy, wouldn't that be wonderful.
It really would. I mean, and it's incredible that this opportunity has presented itself. I mean, this is something that I really think needs to happen, and we definitely want to keep up with you on this and see how it unfolds. But it's such an awesome opportunity. Let's go back to the Kensington Runestone real quick, Scott. I know that you had talked a little bit about how that drew you into this world and how that was kind of, you know, your entry point to this world of ancient mystery. Tell us a little bit more about the stone itself. Explain the artifact. What is it? And what does this actually mean for the secret history of America?
Well, you know, the Kensington Runestone has become sort of my baby, I guess you could say.
Sure.
And for a lot of reasons. And I've spent a lot of time on it. And you know, one of the things that, well, first off, let me just explain. It was found in 1898 by a Swedish immigrant farmer by the name of Olof Öhman, who was clearing trees on his roughly 100-acre parcel of property in preparation for farming. And while he was clearing trees with his two oldest sons, he tipped over a 25-to-30-year-old aspen tree, and tightly wrapped in the roots was this 202-pound stone that eventually was realized contained a very long inscription carved in Scandinavian runes that for a long time was believed to tell a story about a journey of 30 Scandinavian explorers into the heartland of North America.
Okay.
What we have since come to realize through working with scholars for a few years who have since renounced a lot of the work that we've done for personal reasons. The work that we accomplished together still stands and will stand up to scrutiny. This is kind of a sad chapter that has happened in the course of the work that I've done, but it is what it is.
Right.
And anyway, what we've since discovered through the collaboration of geology and linguistics and runology was that the inscription actually is a land claim by this medieval party. I've also recently written a long paper about a discovery that I made after becoming a Freemason and going through the higher degrees of the York Rite branch of Freemasonry, that in fact the runestone was carved by an initiated Cistercian monk. And that the message is indeed a land claim that has certain aspects of the inscription that talk about other things that are real. But the bulk of the inscription is allegory and code and is a very carefully crafted message with multiple layers within it that only somebody who's been initiated into the ancient Egyptian mysteries would understand. And until I became a Mason and initiated in the higher degrees of Freemasonry, including the ancient Egyptian mysteries, I never would have understood this. I always had questions about what exactly, what exactly the message was. There were parts of the message that just never made sense to me. And now I understand that they don't make sense if you try to interpret them literally. But once you understand allegory and code, all of a sudden it all makes sense. And now it all makes sense to me. So it's a very important artifact. One of the things that we also discovered geologically is that it's a Minnesota rock. And so therefore somebody came from some place in Scandinavia. They carved the stone and they buried it as a land claim. So based on those facts, we know that they came from somewhere, they came from some place over in Scandinavia, and they came for a reason. And that's the part that I've been working on that's been very difficult, but I think I have all that figured out now as well. And actually, Andrew, the story that has unfolded is nothing short of absolutely incredible. It tells a totally different story about the history of our country and the history of Europe and all the way back to Jerusalem. So it's just, it's amazing. It's nothing short of amazing. And you know that old phrase, the truth is stranger than fiction.
Right.
This is one of those times when that's absolutely true.
And that's, there's some eerie similarities between what you're telling me and the work of our friend Bill Mann, which we're going to come back to in just a bit. Before we go down that rabbit hole, I know that the Kensington Runestone is also kind of what led the way for you to unravel the mystery of the Hooked X. We do have to take a quick break, but when we come back, Scott, I want to talk about the Hooked X, its connection to the Runestone, what it means, and the secret connotation behind this symbol. So more from Scott Walter right after the break. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. If you're just tuning in, I'm your host, Andrew, and this week we have the outstanding pleasure of chatting with forensic geologist Scott Walter. I'm sure you're familiar with his show, America Unearthed, and his work surrounding the Kensington Runestone and the Hooked X. Before the break, we were discussing the Kensington Runestone, that being the artifact that drew Scott into the ancient mysteries world. And before the break, we had briefly talked about the Hooked X. So Scott, what I'd like for you to do is explain to us this Hooked X, right? What is it? What does it mean? What implications does it have for the quote-unquote secret history of America?
Wow. Well, you know, the Hooked X was really the final thing within the Kensington inscription. And by the way, I just want to make sure people are aware that the Kensington Runestone doesn't sit in isolation as a runic inscription carved by the Templars. There's actually five in North America. Three more up at Spirit Pond, and then the Narragansett Runestone, which was found across the bay from the Newport Tower, which was also built by the Templars, probably around 1400.
Okay.
But anyway, there are multiple artifacts, and when I talk about the Runestone, the Hooked X, just remember that there's four more. There's a total of five.
Right.
But anyway, the Hooked X was the one symbol carved on the stone that when I went to Scandinavia five times researching all the runes, the dialect, the grammar, the dating on the stone, and found all the evidence that was supposedly never existed. And you got to understand too, I use simple logic that if the weathering told me that the artifact was old, therefore it had to be genuine. Therefore, everything in that inscription had to exist in the 14th century. Mm-hmm. It had to, based on logic, and of course it all did. But the one thing I was not able to find in Scandinavia was the Hooked X. That was the last symbol which was being used for the letter A or the A sound in the inscription. And but knowing it had to exist, I just kept going. And the long and the short of it is that the Hooked X was found associated with only two groups, the modern day Freemasons and the medieval order of Knights Templar and Cistercians.
Okay.
And to me, the Hooked X serves as a connecting point between the two orders, which of course are connected ideologically. And really what I discovered was that the Hooked X not only was being used for the letter A, but it also was symbolic or represented an ideology, the true ideology of the people that created the Runestone, of the Cistercians and Knights Templar leadership, and of the leadership of the Freemasons that founded this country. It stands for monotheistic dualism, which is an ancient faith that goes all the way back to Akhenaten in Egypt, when he was the heretic pharaoh that changed the religion in Egypt, or attempted to change the religion in Egypt from polytheistic dualism to monotheistic dualism. And what we see is a continuous thread throughout history that goes from Akhenaten through Jesus and Mary Magdalene and their followers in the Essene, all the way through to the Templars and into modern day Freemasonry.
Wow.
Now, a lot of people that passed on the knowledge Some understood what they were doing, most did not, including most modern-day Freemasons. And I can tell you, because I've been through all the degrees in the Scottish Rite and all the degrees of the York Rite, and, you know, without breaking any of the vows of secrecy that I took, what I can tell you in a general sense is that there is a lot of ancient knowledge that is preserved within the rituals that we perform that we don't even know we're passing along. And some of it I think guys get, but most of it we don't get. And I'm talking about myself. There's a lot in there that I can't decipher either.
Sure.
And so it's a very, very, very important institution that I know there are many scholars, Masonic scholars, who do understand that and have deciphered a lot of the information. I just haven't read their stuff yet, but because I haven't been a Mason very long.
Sure.
But I can tell you that it's vitally important. And as I said before, I did make a discovery recently of something that tied directly to the runestone within one of our degrees that is now being reviewed for publication. But I can tell you that it's a piece of evidence that ties the Templars and the Cistercians to modern Freemasonry. There's no question about it. It's not even something that should be debated anymore.
Right.
But really what we're talking about is ideas and ideology, and that's what the Hooked X represents. And it's amazing. And really this ideology and the symbolism that represents it is all around us, especially in this country, because the runestone was really the beginning of the founding of this country in the form of a land claim. And the guys who continued that ideology finished the job.
Right.
And I'm talking about the founding fathers of our country who, funny, were pretty much all Freemasons.
You know, your wife and Alan Butler were on the show not too long ago, and we talked about that briefly. And it's funny that you say that the ideology of the Templars and the Freemasons are everywhere. I can't seem to get away from it, Scott. I mean, everybody that I've brought on the show lately, somehow, one way or another, we end up talking Templars, which is, I love it, because that's such a fascinating topic for me. And I know in our aside offline, you and I have talked about our mutual friend Bill Mann and his work with respect to the Templars in America. One of the things I love about your work, Scott, is that it definitely reinforces the diffusionist view of pre-Columbian transoceanic contact. And you tie a lot of that to the Templars. So maybe for our listeners that aren't super familiar with what that looked like in that time period, maybe walk us through what your research has shown you of the Templars having come to America. When were they here? Why were they here? And what did they do?
Well, that's a lot.
But, yeah, it's a loaded question for sure.
but anyway, I think I'd like to take a step back and say that really, we're not just talking about the Templars. The Templars, per se, as an official medieval military monastic order, existed for only about, well, they started circa 1100.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is they never went anywhere. I mean, people say the Templars were put down in 1307. The Templar order did not end in 1307. They just changed into something a little bit different, but they continued on as an official order in Portugal under the name of the Order of Christ up until 1835 officially. But Templarism is alive and well today. They have not gone anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Mann would tell you the same thing, because he's a Templar himself.
Right.
And he understands this. Anyway, but back, you know, I think what I wanted to say is that the people that we're talking about is really a group of families, bloodline families that go back thousands of years, but they were in leadership positions throughout different points in history.
You talking the Venus families?
The Venus families,
right.
And that's the term that Janet and Alan and I came up with together to describe these people. And they were coming to not just the Americas, but they were going all over the world for thousands of years. We see evidence of them here in North America for sure with the Bat Creek stone back in the first century, with the Tucson lead artifacts in the 8th and 9th centuries, and then with the various Hooked X rune stones, if you will, the Newport Tower and other artifacts in medieval times. Mm-hmm. So they've been coming here the whole time, and they've been interacting with Native Americans. And the reason that they interacted so well with Native Americans is because they shared a similar ideology. And that ideology, as we've already said, was monotheistic dualism. And the idea of dualism is the concept of opposites that keep things in balance. Male, female, heaven and earth, good, bad, light, dark, yin-yang, if you will.
Sure.
This whole idea of living in balance. And I would ask people, is there any other culture in the world that understands how to live in balance with nature better than Native Americans?
Right.
I would argue no.
Right.
But anyway, that is why they were successful here. They shared an ideology. They shared rituals. They shared their blood. That is how you get along with Native Americans, and they understood how to do that. When the Vikings came here about 1,000 years ago, they tried to get a foothold here, but they had a different ideology. And the natives took them out. Mm-hmm. At least that's what they've told me. That's what they've told Bill. And that appears to be the case, because why didn't they stay and flourish? And I think it had everything to do with ideology, and the natives just wouldn't put up with it.
Sure.
So when they came back, when the Templars came back, these Venus families that had already been here multiple times, probably for thousands of years, going back to the Phoenicians and beyond, that ideology was the key thing that helped them be successful here. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, you know, a lot of the naysayers will say, well, that's a bunch of BS. Well, you can't prove that it didn't happen. And, you know, the other thing that I find interesting about people that want to, you know, deny all this and attack and criticize it is it's all a negative argument. They can't put any evidence to prove that it didn't happen. And in fact, these guys were operating in extreme secrecy, because if you look at what was happening to them in Europe, they were being persecuted. They've been persecuted for thousands of years.
Right.
So if they have a place where they can operate successfully, they're not going to tell anybody. They're not going to write it down and put it in a book and say, hey, we're over here dealing with people that are cooperating with us, that are helping us, that are teaching us. We've got access to wood, to fish, to precious metals, to anything and everything we want. We're not going to tell you.
Right.
I mean, what the hell? I mean, it's, to me, it's just patently obvious. And for people to deny it is just... it's just silly.
Yeah.
It's just dumb.
You know, you mentioned that the Venus families for thousands of years have been traveling all over the globe. And it got me thinking, have you put any thought, I'm sure you have, into the Venus families ultimately being responsible for the source maps that the Piri Reis map and the Orontes Phineus map were based on? I mean, have you looked at that angle of it?
Absolutely. I mean, I haven't really studied that in detail. It's an area that I haven't looked at, but look, the evidence of the influence of the Venus family is everywhere.
Yeah.
You just have to know where to look. It's sometimes it's as straightforward as something like a map or a document. There are documents that exist. Of course, the Roman Catholic Church has tucked away as many of those as they could get their hands on.
Sure.
But they'll come out eventually. They will. I mean, if there's one thing that I think we all understand, is sooner or later those dirty little secrets, they come out, don't they?
Yeah.
You know, and I say the same thing to people about this. I said, look, this may be shocking and unexpected. you know, who is here, why they were here, what the Hooked X means, how it relates to Jesus and Mary, and the fact that they were a part of this story. It's shocking to some people, but you know, when some shocking secret comes forward in anyone's life, at first they're taken aback, they can't believe it, And then 5 minutes later, they go, okay, well, I guess I just have to deal with it and move on.
Right.
And that's the way life is. And that'll happen in this case, too. We just have to get these donkeys to get off their high horses and get with the program.
Right.
And you know, I'll tell you what my strategy, Andrew, was I gave up on the academics a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't want to be honest. They don't want to be objective. They don't want change.
Right.
And to be honest with you, I don't even really care what their reasons are. Change has to happen.
Well said.
And so what I've done is I've gone to the masses. That's why we did the show. That's why we do the books. That's why we do the documentaries. That's why we're going to continue to do those things.
Mm-hmm.
Because sooner or later, if enough everyday people and people of influence start to say, wait a minute, I get this stuff. What's wrong with you guys? Pretty soon the money's going to start to dry up.
Right.
Pressure's going to be put on them. And it's the money that's going to change it.
Right.
Because when they start, you know, when the funding starts to dry up for their pet projects and for, you know, tenure of professors that are not helping educate people the way that they should be educated, that's when things are going to change.
Yep.
And unfortunately, we have, you know, the Wild West days of the internet right now. And most people are lazy when they go on the internet and they're finding things that are not helping with us setting this record straight.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not really sure what the answer is, but we have to fix things on the internet as well, because it's people are getting a distorted picture, and it's muddying the water even more than it already is.
Are you trying to say that everything on the internet's not rooted in fact, Scott?
Wikipedia isn't a reliable source. Yes, that is what I'm saying.
We have time for one more question, and this is one that I've for a long time wanted to pick your brain about. I know we're probably not going to have time to do it justice, but Oak Island is an area that has always fascinated me, not just because of the work that the Lagina brothers are currently doing there and the work that your show has done on the island as well, but you know, there's so much mystery surrounding that island. 35,000-foot view from you, Scott. What does your research tell us about this place? What do you think happened there? What do you think could be buried there, if anything? Do you think that it was the Templars? Kind of give us your thoughts on Oak Island for real quick.
Well, Oak Island is the most overrated nothing that there could possibly be. I say that because I've been asked 1,000 times.
Right.
There's nothing on the island. Absolutely nothing. Now, there as far as treasure goes, anything that may have been there in the past was moved inland centuries ago.
Mm-hmm.
If it was related to the Templars, which I think is a strong possibility, all I can tell you is they're not stupid. They didn't leave their stuff laying around for the brothers to find.
Right.
And the brothers know that. That's all TV. Everything on that show is made up. There's nothing of any tangible value there, in my opinion.
Sure.
However, Nova Scotia is a fertile ground for not just the Templars, but I think multiple cultures going back thousands of years. And I think we see some of the evidence there. I think there's a lot more to be mined from that, but putting all the attention on this tiny little island that, you know, there's no flood tunnels there. There's no multiple levels every 10 feet. The flood tunnels are nothing more than the water table. It's an end glacial sand and gravel moraine island
mm-hmm.
on the ocean.
Right.
It's a water table. That's the reason it floods. It has nothing to do with the Templars building traps. It's nonsense.
Right.
So I hate to break it to people, but I've been there multiple times before I ever did the show, and it's not interesting to me at all. It's time to move on from Oak Island.
Sure, but definitely served as a waypoint for the Templars throughout their travels.
Well,
yes,
I'm sure that they were there, but again, you know, it's just one of many islands that are part of that area of Nova Scotia.
Right.
And I think that they went to many of the islands. I don't think Oak Island was that special.
Sure.
I just don't.
So let me ask you this then. What's next for Scott Walter? I mean, are you working on a new book? Do you have any speaking engagements coming up that the public can attend? How can people connect with you online? Do you have a website? Just kind of share with us your next steps.
Well, actually, I partnered recently with Hutton Pulitzer, who was a guest on Oak Island. And Hutton is he's a fascinating guy. He's a very polarizing figure because he's very outspoken. But I can tell you this, he's a good guy. He's very, very passionate about history, about trying to get the history right. And we have formed a new company called Explorer, spelled Hooked X, P-L, little r, big R with a dot in the middle, which is an ode to the Kensington Runestone.
Very cool.
But we are in the process of getting our funding together for some of our really exciting projects that we're going to be working on. I don't want to reveal too much about it right now, but I will tell you that we are going to develop some of the ideas and storylines that we've talked about today with the Templars, the Hooked X, Bill Mann's work, and beyond. So this is a story that needs to be told. It's going to be told, and it's going to be told in an intelligent way. We're not going to do this silly build up to nothing type of television that you see on cable nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I'm going to say right now. We have some really, really amazing things that are coming. So I'm excited about that. I'm also working on a new book that is going to flesh out this story in detail and some of the new discoveries that we've talked about briefly. I don't know what it's going to be called yet, but it's going to be good. I encourage people to come to my blog site. They can read about some of these new discoveries at scottwalteranswers.blogspot.com and to our website, which is www.hookedx.com, spelled HOOKEDX.com. And I know you're going to be seeing more announcements coming from Explore through myself and Hutton. There's so much work to be done. There's so much to be shared with the public that it's just mind-boggling. And hopefully we're going to be able to reach across to some of these academics and figure out a way to work with them, because there's plenty of opportunity for them as well. And sooner or later, the smart ones are going to pick up on it. And I think they're going to be excited about some of the new information, the new history, or I should say the correct history that's going to unfold to not just us, but to them as well, and eventually to the world. So stay tuned. A lot more is coming.
Yeah, we can't wait to watch all of that unfold. And, you know, our listeners and our readers, I'm sure will definitely check out the sites and stay up to speed with all things Scott Walter. So, Scott, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. I look forward to bringing you back on the show after your new book comes out so we can discuss what you've been working on in more detail.
Yes.
But it's been a pleasure picking your brain today. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you for having me, Andrew. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to the next time.
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's episode of Lost Origins. I hope that you guys enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. I've been a fan of Scott's work for a very long time, and it was an honor to pick his brain. Check out his websites. You can also pick up his books on Amazon.com. Fascinating, fascinating stuff, you guys. Make sure that you hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode or an article from your friends here at Lost Origins. Make sure that you guys tune in next week when we're going to be chatting with Eric Van Daniken about all things ancient astronaut theory. So if you're a fan of those concepts, that's definitely an episode you do not want to miss. Until next time, I'm your host, Andrew, and I want you to continue to question everything.